is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And a very good afternoon to everyone listening because the Country Hour is celebrating its 80th birthday. We're here in Tamworth at the Ag Institute, where, in fact, they've just celebrated their birthday. Not quite 80 years, but we'll be talking about that in a moment. And I'm joined by Lara Webster and Amelia Bernasconi. Lara, your memories of the Country Hour.
Well,
not 80 years.
Well, I was going to say Amelia and I were talking about still being spring chickens, but I'm going to reveal my mum's age a little bit, and I hope she's not listening. Mm. She probably is. Yep. But I remember my mum always talking when I got a job as a cadet about 10, 11, 12 years ago. Not good with numbers, Condo. That's why we're journos. But I always remember my mum talking about Blue Hills. That was, she'd say, oh my goodness, I remember the days of Blue Hills, and that would be there. That was a tradition for them. Yep. To sit, and her parents to sit and listen to it, and she still remembers
27
it.
27 years of Blue Hills.
Yes.
On the Country Hour.
And she remembers it so fondly. Mm. I think. So yeah, look, I'm trying to carry the flame with the new generations
and,
of us.
And Amelia, you were saying that you were told to be quiet during the Country
Hour. Yeah, I don't think anyone's ever told me to stop talking as much as my grandmother at 12:05. But I worry, though, that we are going to get calls saying bring Blue Hills back, and I don't know how we would do that in 2025. But look, I think we're putting it out there. Anything can happen as we celebrate 80 years, except changing the markets, changing the weather. None of that will.
That won't happen.
Because that's been the key, hasn't it? That's what
tradition.
In 1945, John Douglas went to Charles Moses and said, we need a program with news, market information and weather.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we need in the Country Hour. That's what we need for farmers to know. And also he wanted innovation. Innovation. Mm. New things, new ideas, growing crops better. Better food production. That was why they set up the Country Hour in the first place. Mm.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Lara and I will claim to be spring chickens. I think I've been in the rural team for about 5 years now, on and off, and I think that's something we still see in regional communities. There's so many passionate people out there, you know, growing the food and fibre for us, but also, you know, the communities that people want to live in. They want the teachers to come out there and enjoy it. They want the hospital staff. It is everything that when agriculture is doing well, the regional towns do well, and I think we have the best job in the world to go and cover it all.
I think we do. I think, you know, we get to share so many stories, and I think people love to hear what other people are doing, and we know farmers like to look over the fence at what they're doing, and they get to come to the Country Hour and hear about what people are doing across the state, and we get to share that.
Quite right. And in terms of seeing what people do over the fence and maybe innovation, we're joined now by Guy McMullen, who's the Director of Cropping Systems here at the Tamworth Ag Institute. Thanks for hosting the Country Hour for its 80th birthday.
Yeah, no worries, Connor, and happy birthday to the Country Hour.
Yeah, it's great. Now, this organisation has been around for a long time as well.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. We're at the Ag Institute here. We just celebrated our 75th birthday, so not quite as old as the Country Hour, but and with similar principles driving kind of the Ag Institute research and development in developing new innovations, new technologies to support growers and producers. And our focus is pretty strongly on cropping primarily here, but also some really fundamental research in pasture production and pasture supply as well.
So in that sort of 75, when you're talking about 75 years, we saw the genetic explosion, the green revolution, we saw dwarf wheats, that all that's happened in that time.
Yeah, and the Ag Institute here, through generations of researchers, has really been a really important component of the delivery of that to growers. So, you know, it was started as a wheat variety evaluation centre originally in the late 50s, and that was when we were starting to see the green revolution, semi-dwarf wheats, more use of nitrogen, and that was an explosion happening across the world. But Tamworth was an important component of, you know, bringing that technology, evaluating it in regional environments, and delivering the best technology for growers across the Northwest.
And that GM technology as well, which has made a big difference in terms of the cotton industry in particular, but also, you know, no-till has really taken off. In my time as a rural reporter, I remember hardly anyone did it in 92, and it's just exploded. Now everyone does it.
And the research into no-till started here in the late 70s, like in 1978, and we saw glyphosate come out, which kind of changed the game in terms of managing weeds. But the no-till research that started here and was run right across the Northwest by people like Warwick Felton and Harry Marcellos, you know, names that were really well known locally, you know, really did support the industry in making that shift, and particularly in northwestern New South Wales, you know, it has become an absolutely critical component of our farming system is no-till. But then also about what are the challenges that were created from no-till. It wasn't all smooth sailing. There was a lot of other areas, and so then we saw the crop rotation and the need for different crops. And so DPI, Department of Ag at the time, was fundamental in really developing the chickpea industry in the northwest, which has become such a big success story as well. So taking really unadapted chickpea varieties or types from overseas.
And that's really taken off.
Oh, and absolutely. It was a $1 billion industry last year for us in New South Wales. And again, lots of challenges through that process. Disease, ascochyta blight decimated the industry in 98, and it was our pathologists working with the breeders, coming up with management packages and better, more disease-resistant varieties as well.
What stands out for you then, I suppose, Guy? I mean, we're standing here reflecting on 80 years of the Country Hour, but you're standing here at the Ag Institute in 2025. You have over 200 staff here now. What are the big things for you, the big moments that you look at, or those memories that stay with you and that reflection of how much you've grown on this site?
I think the thing that sticks with me is really the passionate researchers that I've been privileged enough to work with, but the ones that have come before us, because we're always building on that fundamental knowledge that is built by the generations past. And we do things very differently now compared to how we used to, and that's just part of helping develop and support new technology. So that's fundamental change that we have to make. But yeah, it's always the people you work with, the growers and agronomists that we work with in the industry as well, and having that connectivity right across the industry. And we work really closely with a whole range of organisations, from the Grains Research and Development Corporation, Cotton, and also, you know, universities, CSIRO. It's a really collaborative, sometimes a little bit competitive kind of area, which is okay. You need a little bit of competition to kind of keep everyone moving forward. So, but yeah, it's always the people we work with. It's a great industry, and agriculture is just a great sector to work in.
It is indeed, and we really appreciate the fact that you hosted us here. Thanks for joining us on the Country Hour today.
No worries, and happy birthday again.
Thanks for that. You're listening to the Country Hour. I'm joined here by Lara Webster and Amelia Bernasconi, and Jenny Bailey has joined it. We needed a historian. Jenny Bailey's actually literally written the book. I mean, I know it's been a difficult time for Jenny with the loss of Sam recently, but we thought it was important to get you along here today because you literally, you've written the book about the history.
A while ago. We're talking 95 that I wrote that. But yes, I did for the 50th anniversary, and it's a bit scary to think it's now 30 years since that occasion. But it was...
But it holds up well.
Well, the good thing about it was that we were still able to interview most of the... not John Douglas, but a lot of the earlier rural reporters particularly were still alive at that stage, which was wonderful because I was able to sit down with them and you know, interview them and gather all that history that would have been lost if we'd waited till 80 years, obviously. And they better collect ours soon because we've probably got as well.
You mentioned John Douglas, and I remember reading some stuff about John, about how he was a difficult character. He was used to bang the table, he used to have arguments with Charles Moses, the head of the ABC, demanding that they have rural reporters and things like that. They said that he was the sort of guy that would walk through a brick wall and get someone else to pick up the pieces afterwards.
That's very true from what I gather, absolutely. But I think that flowed through to what the rural department became, because he was so passionate about it. But not only that, he employed passionate people as well, which means...
Dirt under the fingernails.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And I think that even today is still there, that we... And I know myself, when I was a rural reporter, we just cared so much about what we were doing. We cared so much about being part of the rural department. We cared so much about the farmers that were listening to us and supporting them through those ups and downs, the droughts, the floods, all of those things. And, you know, it's wonderful we're still doing that now, 80 years later. Wouldn't he be proud?
I think so.
You mentioned before, Jenny, that you would spend weeks on the road at a time, and I think that's a bit of a luxury that Lara and I would enjoy these days. But you'd go and immerse yourself in communities, you'd get the stories, and I imagine it was the same then too, that you're just welcomed into these tiny little pockets of the countryside, you know, with the ABC microphone.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that it's a very special role to have as a rural reporter, because we are special within the ABC and we're seen that way by the listeners. And we do, they do feel like they know us, and they really do connect with us in a very special way. And, you know, and that's part of the reason that when my husband, you know, proposed to me live on the radio, I got such a reaction, because everyone felt like they knew me.
Yeah.
And that's, and we've got that connection too, so when we ask people to ring up about rainfall or, you know, whatever, just they all ring in because they know us and they feel like they know us.
And the reporters are in the field all the time as well, which is a difference too.
Oh, absolutely. I can remember wading waist-deep through water in the gingham wetland, covering a huge bird nesting with my Nagra above my shoulders. But that's the sort of thing we did, and it was wonderful because the sounds that we captured that we could then blend through the stories was incredible, and it was a very special thing to get to do, and that was one of the wonderful parts of our job, wasn't it?
And I suppose too, farmers and those in their small communities, they let us into their lives at the very best and the very worst times, and they open their doors to us and they share that with us. I mean, how important was that for you over your career? I mean, you witnessed the very best and worst when you were rural reporting.
Yeah, I did. But I think we also had a role to support them. And I know, you know, you guys probably supported them through the most recent dreadful drought, but in the early 90s we had one too. And sheep were being were worth a dollar each, and people were having to go and shoot their sheep, and then because there was a drought, and we had to, our job was to be there for them too. And that's why they welcome us into our homes, because we did that, you know, tried to do the light stories, tried to tell everyone what was going on, and you're still doing it. And so it's a two-way thing.
Something that we've discovered, well, you know, not discovered, but I guess something that we are always conscious of as reporters as well, is that there are those primary producers on the land, but then a lot of our listeners are probably the consumers. And I'm just thinking now back to that most recent drought when, you know, a lot of our stories were getting more coverage outside the rural team. They were going into the metros, they were on the nightly news. How do you think that goes in, you know, we talk about the city-country divide. Is there less of a divide these days, or is there more understanding?
Well, I think COVID improved things. I think there was less of a divide during COVID. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that that's continued, but it is wonderful that your stories are going further afield, obviously, now compared to what they were back then. So, you know, obviously that's helping, but it's a massive challenge. And, you know, the more people that come into Australia that don't have a rural background, you know, which is increasingly the migrants that move to Australia. I mean, once upon a time, all our little country towns were full of the Chinese, you know, that grew the food, and the, you know, the Polish bootmaker, and the Lebanese who had the clothing shop. And we had all these migrants living in rural areas connected to agriculture. That's not happening anymore. So you guys' role is so vital in that sense.
Well, Jenny Bailey, I think we should say a big thank you to you and to Sam for everything you've done for rural Australia as well, and paving the way for little old us too. And Condo.
You're very, very welcome.
Thanks, Jenny.
Jen Bailey there, our resident historian. So yeah, you're going to do another book. You're going to... Do one for 80.
Commissioning for the 80th book today. It might have to be a podcast.
Commissioned you
next
to
time.
Do another book. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to 18 past 12.
Top entertainment's just a heartbeat away.
You just got to know where to look.
The Family Next Door, Return to Paradise, Portrait Artist of the Year, Austin, and Mystery Road Origin, where it's always free, always entertaining, ABC iView.
And here we're celebrating 80 years of The Country Hour, and we're joined by Tony Windsor, who used to be the only independent for New England, but there's going to be a new one now, Tony. welcome to the program. Thoughts on that initially?
Oh, I won't get into the domestic politics. Everybody's elected as an independent. There's no such thing as a party member in our constitution, so people can chop and change if they want to. I think I might leave that bit.
Leave it at that.
This is a day of celebration rather than doom.
And well, you're saying something there, aren't you? And your reflections on The Country Hour, Tony. You've been around a bit.
I'm 75 now, so nearly as old as The Country Hour. I remember the Blue Hills. So, it was a great show. I used to listen to it. But The Country Hour's been... I think Jenny summed it up. It's the contact of the individuals that are on air, yourself included, but also guys on the ground everywhere. That's something, that credibility is something that's hard to come by, and you've been able to develop that over the years. So, and people engage as they would have 20, 30, 40 years ago. Different personalities with the same business plan.
But what about the, you know, that city-country divide? Now, you were in Canberra, of course, you know, cutting through that, you know, not easier said than done, isn't it?
Well, it is. I think there's a number of messages there, though. The point Jenny was making about relatives living in the country and, you know, everybody went out to Uncle Sam property to chase rabbits at one stage in their life. Those days have probably gone. So I think country people, there's a bit of a challenge to country people as well there, that they've got to actually not see the city people as the enemy, because they've got the numbers. They've got the numbers, the raw politics are, and that's going to get worse in terms of numbers, or better for city people. And I think issues, the big issues that are out there, climate change, for instance, unless we really engage in that debate, we may well see our city cousins, who rarely know us anymore, suggesting that, well, if you people think climate change is normal, we'll put up with it. But don't come to our majority governments for handouts when you get what you consider to be a normal drought. So I think there's a real challenge there to not fall prey to the sort of simplistic politics of what's happening globally, and particularly climate change.
So to be at the table, putting your case forcefully about what's happening and what help is needed, perhaps.
Well, we should be leading the debate.
Hmm.
And if you lead the debate, you can go to any government persuasion and ask for assistance in terms of a positive future. But if you're just running a negative debate, which is easily, it's populist, it gets you through the short term of politics, but it doesn't really provide for the future. And I think agriculture and country people generally, they're at a little bit of a crossroads there as to, do we want to be serious about it? If we are serious, the very fact that you're here today is about science. Agriculture, all the innovations, you know, the Warwick Feltons of this world, the John Knipes that came out of here, the Kevin Moores, the Ray Hares, those guys. You know, Ray Hare developed durum wheat, for instance. Kevin Moore was a plant pathologist in terms of chickpeas. Obviously, Warwick Feltons developed the concept of the camera technology and no-till technology. All of that that we're practicing now is because of what scientists did in the past. And I think we've got to just make sure we stop denigrating the scientists and actually engage with them and make them part of the future for the future generations.
Well, that's why we have the wheat breeders going for the wheats that are drought tolerant, that will take more heat, bringing in different varieties of chickpeas and things that are more used to the hot weather and things like that, and less water. All of that's happening as a result of, you know, those climate issues as well.
Yeah, we've got the people to do the work. There's no doubt about that. But the point I'm making is, if we keep denigrating science,
yep,
people will be less interested in going into that sort of vocation area. We need those people. Yeah,
but farmers are big on innovation too, and we've seen that in recent, you know, over that 80 years, there's been massive changes.
Very much so. Warwick Feltons again developed the concept of the Brownhill family, not far from here, actually. Bought the camera concept, or took it to the States first and then bought it back. You know, that's now, that is global. So the farm sector's had an enormous impact on the Australian farm sector, on global agriculture.
Mm. Tony Windsor, appreciate your time, and thanks for coming and celebrating the Country Hour's 80th and joining us on the program. Thank you.
You don't look a day over 77.
Thanks for
that. I was
that.
Waiting for someone.
The backhanded
Thanks,
compliment there from Tony Windsor. You're listening to the Country Hour. It's coming up to 24 minutes past 12.
80 years of the Country Hour.
Pretty sure I probably listened to the first Country Hour episode.
That's amazing, Ian. So you would have been coming back, yes, from war, wanting to find out a little bit more about farming.
That's right.
And have you been listening ever since, eh?
Yes, still listening today. it was really good for the country farming community to get all the reports and hear what was going on around the country, I guess, was the main thing.
Thanks so much for the call, mate.
Keep the good work going.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
We're joined now by Hugh Killen, who's a former CEO of AACo, but now heading up, talking about ag innovation, impact ag, innovative ag, and this is the perfect place for it here at the Ag Institute in Tamworth. Thanks for joining us on the Country Hour.
Type of place we're very used to being around, actually. But what a pleasure to be here today, and I actually feel quite honoured to be invited to come along, so thank you for having me.
Well, can I just say, you're actually towering over all of us. You know, I never quite realised how tall you were.
Well, the three of us will dress the same, though, I suppose. Yeah.
Oh, we've got the dress code.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Hugh Killen, I mean, I guess, first of all, maybe we start with your reflections on the Country Hour. I mean, you've been obviously engaged in the beef industry for a long time, but I know you've also been a listener of the Country Hour too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I grew up in the bush, and it was one of these things that connected the city and the country all of my life. And, you know, I think it was important then, but it's probably even more important now. You know, that narrative around what happens in regional and rural Australia is held so beautifully by the ABC, and I think it's seen as a... especially in this show, as a source of information, and it's straightforward and people can consume it. And, you know, I remember giving... I was working in the US once, and I gave a update once on what was happening in currency markets from New York, and I did it to the early breakfast news in Australia and didn't get much of a hit from anyone. Then all of a sudden it was played on Country Hour later in the day, and there was... everyone from my auntie to my parents' friends are calling up. So it's got very big reach, you know. It's a really important thing for the bush.
Talking about the red meat industry, so it's been a real roller coaster ride. No doubt you would have seen that. And now it's sort of on the up. Is it, you know, I mean, I mean, how do you see red meat in the future? Is it a lot of people really talking it up at the moment?
I think... the red meat market in general, particularly beef, is in a really purple patch, and I think it's going to continue to grow. I think the practices that we have, the way around we're growing our cattle at the moment, are world leading. I think the demand for protein is going to continue to grow. Our export markets are very robust. The US cow herd will probably never recover to the levels it was at before, and Australia's an important market.
Is that
market,
right? That's a big call?
I don't think so. No, I think if when you read the analysts that really understand this stuff, you know, that sell down of their herd is absolutely huge. And I just, you know, it's there's a lot of smallholders there. The average cow herd in America is like 90 head. So, you know, it's not like Australia where we've got big pastoral companies that can run, you know, hundreds of thousands of head and actually supply through those peaks and troughs that you're talking about. So I think overall, the beef industry is in robust health. It will have some headwinds. It will have some headwinds around things like climate change. We need to get the science right and the frameworks right around the biogenic methane carbon life cycle. I think that needs some more work to be done. But, you know, and I think some education around the consumer's choice around high value, high health protein, which, you know, you guys try to do with the city every day of the week as well.
That's an interesting point. But so there's still more work to be done with the genetics and lowering the methane.
I think it's actually around the science about how we count for methane. And I think if we treat methane the same as we do carbon dioxide in the environment, well, then we're probably overrepresenting the impact of cattle on the environment. And I think, you know, the best science that I understand from people that have really understood this clearly will show that it's a lot less than actually that's accounted for. So the carbon accounting frameworks globally around methane in cattle, I think, actually need to be reviewed, and they're probably flawed. So it's around what the actual baseline is. So cattle do emit. I'm not saying that they don't. But my point is, as we think about the impact of cattle and global warming, there actually can be a solution. And I think, you know, we're talking about innovation. Tony was talking about innovation in the last interview. We actually have regulatory frameworks in Australia that can drive innovation, especially into things like the cattle industry. You know, you think about putting a price on carbon markets. You know, Australian farmers, in particular beef farmers on high rainfall pastures, can actually be a supply carbon to help decarbonise the economy. So, you know, there's kind of these dual things that are happening on farm balance sheets now, and I think the beef industry are right in the middle of that if they can embrace it and really understand it, and we can get the policy settings right.
You talk about the strength of the exports. I mean, you know, the cattle market, things like that. In the next 5 years or so, Hugh, what do you see as the biggest challenges for the red meat sector? Are we talking about, you know, disease incursions from overseas? What do you think we'll need to stay on top of to keep this industry in such good form?
Well, if you think about some of the capital we work with, which is, you know, say, people outside of Australia looking to invest in agriculture, they get worried about animal agriculture from an animal welfare perspective. So that's kind of one of the first things we've got to continue to do a good job on. Australia World leads in that. But I think it's a ticket to play. I think it shouldn't be something that we say, look, we've got great welfare. It just is a ticket to play. I think people understanding where their protein comes from and being connected back into food supply chains, I think, shows what this are really important around connecting and helping people understand where food comes from. And there isn't a protein that sits around in terms of, you know, the grams of protein you get from red meat that we get from beef. So how we tell that story with people to understand, you know, that red meat's a really valuable part of their diets, not just here in Australia, but globally. And then I think, you know, ultimately, you know, how we tell that story and how we all kind of pull together on that is super important.
Mm. That means I'll have to have a steak tonight.
100%. What's your favourite steak? That's what Kerry Underwood asked me.
I really do like a rump steak. I know that people sort of talk it down, but I like a big rump. Yeah.
Well, Australia's the largest consumer of rump steak in the world.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
What about you, Hugh?
Oh, I still like a ribeye, to be honest. Yeah. I know that's an easy answer, but it's okay.
Hugh, appreciate your time on the Country Hour and appreciate that you made the time to come and have a chat on our 80th birthday.
Thank you for having me and happy birthday.
Thank you. It's before we go to news and weather, let's hear a bit from some of our rural reporters who couldn't be here today, some of their reflections on the Country Hour.
On ABC Radio New South Wales, this is the New South Wales Country Hour.
Hi, Josh Becker here, rural reporter based in southeast New South Wales in Bega. And the story I'll never forget is some of the emergency broadcasting through Black Summer. We were reading out warning after warning, many of which were telling people it's too late to leave their properties. And then in the aftermath, interviewing farmers who shared their stories with the Country Hour. It was remarkable to hear what they went through, what they lost, and also how they were feeling about the recovery ahead. Some of those stories were raw and brave and reflective, and they'll stay with me forever.
I'm Lauren Bohane. I'm the ABC Rural Reporter for the New South Wales Mid-North Coast in Port Macquarie. And the thing I love most about rural reporting is just how welcoming farmers can be. I don't think I've been to a farm yet where I haven't been offered a cup of tea or a coffee and just a full tour of the property. It doesn't matter what's going on. Farmers are always there to open the door, open the gate, just sit down with me and have a yarn. And I reckon that's the best part of this job of being a rural reporter.
I'm Cara Jeffrey, rural reporter with ABC Riverina in Wagga Wagga. They say don't work with children and animals, but as a rural reporter, that's exactly what we quite often do. And honestly, it's one of the best parts of the gig. Some of my favourite days on the road are when I meet the next generation, kids on farms, at ag shows, in shearing sheds, or out in the paddock. They're always inspiring and refreshing. They tell you exactly what they think, they're full of curiosity, and they usually remind you why you love this job in the first place. Over the years, I've interviewed a 5-year-old who mastered shearing after first practicing on his teddy bears. I've visited students learning to train working dogs at school, and I've shadowed teenage siblings as they plant crops and feed livestock. Their excitement is contagious. And of course, the animals keep you on your toes too. Whether it's dodging an enthusiastic kelpie or trying to record audio near a very talkative cow, it's never dull. It's all part of the charm of rural reporting. And it's what makes every day out on the road feel like a new adventure.
I'm Emily Doak, a rural reporter in the Riverina region. One of the stories that's had the most profound impact on me was in covering the Millennium Drought, when we were reporting on what was going on with the weather, what was happening in communities and what was happening on farm. Both the struggles that farmers were facing in coping with the seasonal conditions, but also the innovative ways and the strategies that they were implementing to deal with the conditions and the way that communities and farmers were pulling together to support each other. So, and reflecting on the 80 years of the Country Hour, I think it's important to remember that giving people a voice and an opportunity to talk about what's happening, good or bad, can be really powerful.
G'day, I'm Emily Middleton, rural reporter for ABC Central West, New South Wales in Orange. One thing I've noticed, which is that no matter how dire the situation could be, look, they could be suffering through the hardest drought they've ever been in, or they could be going through floods or fires. Farmers are almost guaranteed to round out the conversation with, "But that's just farming."
The eternal optimist, Michael Condon. They are, aren't they?
They are, actually, yes, when you think about it. And they go, "Oh, well, you know, that's farming." Exactly.
So-and-so down the road's got it harder than
I
do.
Exactly.
We're fine.
Yeah, that's right. Wouldn't want to be in the Riverina at the moment. I was talking to someone the other day and they were saying that, and they were saying, "Oh, it's tough where they are," but it wouldn't want to be in the Riverina. It's always the message you get. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, look, always that line of, "Oh, it's not great, Lara, but it could be worse, somewhere else."
That's right. Yeah. We should go to some news headlines now. Adam Story.
Yeah, you could be stuck here.
Good
me.
Afternoon.
Yeah, you could be stuck here with me.
Oh, come on.
Come on. Yeah. All right. We have new figures on the economy from the Bureau. The economy has expanded, but at a weaker than expected pace. The latest data shows economic growth, as far as GDP is concerned, was just 0.4% in the September quarter and 2.1% in the year to September. And apparently the major driver of growth was investment from the private sector as businesses ramped up spending on machinery, equipment and data centres. The federal court has dismissed an appeal by Bruce Lehrman in his defamation battle against the Ten Network. He appealed against the federal court finding that on the balance of probabilities he raped Brittany Higgins at Parliament House. But his efforts today failed, with the federal court saying that the court did not err in any way in its original findings. The state's police minister has repeatedly refused to answer questions about allegations that her driver was caught drink driving three times over the legal limit. The government driver allegedly recorded a blood alcohol reading of 0.183 while driving near Bega on the south coast. His licence has been suspended and he's been charged with high-range drink driving, but the minister would not confirm if he was driving a government car or whether he would remain her driver. And Donald Trump says he's terminating all documents that were signed by his predecessor, Joe Biden, which used an auto pen signature. In a post on his social media site, he says anyone receiving pardons, communications or any other document signed by the device will have no legal effect. But the auto pen is used to replicate a person's signature with precision, particularly for high volume documents, and has been used by presidents of both major parties to sign letters over the years. And you there, Michael? Hello?
I am. I am. I wasn't sure you'd finished.
You hear me?
Are you there? Yeah. We're here at Tamworth and we're thinking of you.
Oh, thank you. And I'm thinking of you on your 80th birthday, Michael.
Now, as much as we love Adam's story, I can't let the birthday pass without mentioning Helen Zarimas. And I think everyone's got memories of the non-love affair that was was over the radio airwaves, Michael.
Are you sure about that?
The cardboard cutout of Helen that no one has ever seen, but you apparently were going to bring out to all the outside broadcasts.
We were going to organise to do that for Helen and also for Adam's story as well.
Maybe we could get them together.
Oh, I'm honoured. my own cardboard cutout.
Well, that's right. Yes.
Is there a highlights reel of us? Is there a highlights reel of us, Michael?
Yeah, with our banter. Probably is. No, people keep texting me saying we need to do a podcast.
Yes, I know. And we just keep on saying that.
The ABC gets podcasted these days. We're in the 21st century now, Adam. You're already.
Oh,
on
really?
Podcast.
You've got your own podcast.
We do. Yes. We do. All right, Adam, well, I'll let you get back to it. Because soon you've got to be doing the news.
Yeah, better throw something together for 1 o'clock. Yeah. Time is getting on. Enjoy your day, people.
Oh, we'll do our best too. Right. Absolutely. Thanks for that, Adam. And let's find out what's happening with the weather. There's not much happening in terms of the weather. Brandon Cray joins us again. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So, benign weather conditions today and warming up?
Fairly benign today, all right. And yeah, warming up as we head into tomorrow, heading into the 30s. As we get into tomorrow, fairly widespread. Continuing to heat up then for Friday with more widespread 30s and possibly pushing up into the 40s as well. In terms of showers then for Friday, we could get one or two showers along the coast, but really it's staying fairly dry. And as we head into Saturday, a bit more showery activity as a cold front makes its way across the state. But in terms of accumulations, it's looking fairly light, getting under 5 mils widely for Saturday. Then Sunday, the showery activity becomes confined to the northeastern quarter and possibly getting up to 5 to 10 mils there, especially along the coast. But for the rest of the state, it's staying fairly low in terms of precipitation. Looking ahead then to the rest of Monday and onwards, showers again becoming more confined to the northwest, or northeast rather, and not much going on for the rest of the state, staying fairly dry for the early days of next week.
Right, okay. And so not much in terms of millimetres for the rain?
Not much at all, really, no.
Even over for the next 7 days or so. All right, Brandon, thanks for that.
Thanks, Michael.
It's coming up to 20 minutes to one.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today as the family of Greg Lynn's late first wife reveals the High Country Killer's abusive past as detectives launch a new investigation into her death. Vladimir Putin has warned Europe that Russia is ready for war if Europe seeks one. And former Liberal staffer Bruce Lerman will today learn if he has won or lost his appeal against a finding that, on the balance of probabilities, he did rape Brittany Higgins in Parliament House in 2019. Those stories and more, join me for The World Today.
But here on the Country Hour, celebrating our 80th birthday. And Amelia, we're 80.
We've been stealing the thunder a bit, haven't we?
But the Quast family farm is 75, been going for 75 years.
Happy
and they've joined us here today.
To you, Colin Vicky.
Happy birthday to you too. Thank you. Yes, it's a little bit of a milestone for the Quast family and, probably one of the oldest turkey farms in Australia.
Yeah, what keeps you going? Because we were just talking that you are gearing up for another massive Christmas. Mm. It's sort of a smaller industry than others. What keeps you going?
I suppose it's adrenaline at the moment, sitting out there in the sun nearly falling asleep. But, pride in what we do. You know, I like to think that I actually sat there today and we've got a customer list of 40-odd people, you know, from the bigger customers that we sort of serve all over the place, the wholesalers, all the way down to the small family butcher. And, pride of what we do, that we provide a good product and we provide exactly what they need.
Cole, we've got your other half. I won't say better half, but Vicky Quast is here as well. Vicky, what about you? You've been there along for the ride as well.
Absolutely along for the ride. I find what we do just extraordinary. It's a vertically integrated farm. We breed, hatch, grow, process and market all from the same area. And I just am so in awe of what Colin and our son James actually do, because we also grow grain to feed our birds, which we make on farm, and we compost and use that as fertiliser on our land. And when I talk like this, I think that we'd have nowhere near enough staff, really.
But you've got some young ones running around helping, as I understand.
Yes.
Grandkids.
Yes, they're learning. They're very, very good at moving birds, because we walk them all to the processing room. So, yeah.
Mm.
Yes, they're there.
There's so much pride in farming, and that's something that we always see, isn't it? That multi-generation, and, you know, people are sixth, seventh generation, and it's still with the first generation farmers too. I mean, it doesn't really matter what generation you are, the passion once people get hooked in farming. How would you describe that in the Quast family?
Oh, it runs very deep. We have three sons, and even though the oldest and the youngest don't work on the farm, they did when they were younger and understand the processes, and they feel that same pride and enjoy talking to others about what we do. My older son's had that experience recently, and the questions that they ask, it's because it's so unique, so few people know what goes on.
Cole, we've spoken about your dad in the past too and his legacy. I imagine he'd be awfully proud of everything that's been achieved.
Yes, I'm sure he would be, and he was. He hasn't been gone for all that long. But Yeah, he was just so proud, you know, even when he was on his deathbed, you know, he sort of said, I'm really proud of you and everything that you've done. I think he probably questioned whether I was going to be able to do it when he retired, but he did put his hand up and say how proud he was of me. Mm. So, yeah, that was a touching moment. But, yeah, it's and I'm proud that my son's come onto the farm as well, and I'm also proud that the grandchildren kids are there and enjoying it. Yeah,
absolutely.
And a familiar tale from many family farm situations. What about the Country Hour? Any reflections on the Country Hour?
Look, I have to admit that I try and my lunch sort of doesn't fit with the Country Hour most of the time, but I did make a comment to you earlier that I like to listen to the market report at least on Mondays when it's close to that. But yeah, look, the Country Hour has always been there, and if I can get close to a radio, I'll definitely be listening to the ABC at lunchtime.
I think you've welcomed many a rural reporter at Christmas time.
Yep.
Yes, yep. I'm sure we'll get those phone calls in the next few weeks.
Yep. from Lara Webster.
We need a turkey market report. That's what we need.
Look, the turkey market's been quite buoyant this year. We've got two big players, and we happen to be the biggest of the small players that are left in the turkey industry. So, look, it's been quite buoyant. We will as good as sell out of all our turkeys, but we will still have enough left for our shop, because if we don't do that, we'll ruin someone's Christmas dinner.
Well, Vicky and Cole, of course, thank you so much for coming in today. We really appreciate it. And like we say, Lara will probably swing out in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I was just thinking I'll call you after this. Happy birthday.
Tough act to follow when we talk about the buoyant turkey industry. We bring in John Croke. Sorry about that, John, from Australian Wool Network. But you always find some light in a tumultuous industry as well.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm pretty well blessed here. Like, I'm probably in the best industry in the world, to be quite honest, and especially where they grow some of the best wool in the New England. So it's world renowned, and I'm a very lucky guy, that's for sure. So,
but it's been a roller coaster ride. I'm thinking about that. Certainly, I've been looking at the industry for the last 30 years. Big roller coaster ride there.
Oh, it has. Like, we've seen the ups of the early 2000s where ultrafine wool went through the roof, and the market does go up and down a fair bit, unfortunately. That's probably our greatest bugbear at the moment. We'd like to see a more of a stable type market. That'd be good for all growers, especially, and for industry overall. But unfortunately, we're reliant on overseas markets where they get orders in, they want to buy it, they buy it, and the market might rise, and then when the orders are full, well, they're out, and the market slips back.
John, I've certainly spoken over the last year to plenty of analysts and wool growers, and I think they've said, quite a few of them, this year's been a really different one for some.
It has been. I don't think I've ever seen a year where we've had such a wonderful season. Stock price has been phenomenal. Cattle price has been phenomenal as well, and there's been grass about, so there's a lot more positivity in growers as a whole. Now, I know the wool industry is rising gradually, but they've been able to sort of absorb those prices because of the other sectors have been so good. But there is still a very, very good and strong wool industry, and always will be here in the New England, and it's very positive over the next 2 or 3 years that we will see a small recovery. I'm not going to say it's going to jump back to the days where we were, but very positive that there's a great outlook for the industry.
But the question is about, you know, the demand and whether or not China, being the biggest buyer, and they, you know, they actually manipulate the market to some degree. We need to see more European buyers, really, don't we?
Well, we would, but unfortunately today China do dominate, and it's to do with cost, energy costs throughout the world. I know a couple of the mills there in Italy especially, where they were telling us that their energy costs went up by, you know, 500 to 600%. So it's very, very hard to compete over there, where China can actually do it a lot more cheaper. Mm. And the infrastructure's already in China. Gone are the days where we sort of thought that the Chinese infrastructure was substandard. It's fantastic over there. Their equipment and their foresight of what they're actually doing and the product they're producing is phenomenal. So yes, I can understand what you're saying, that we are sort of, most of the wool is going that way, but we've got to also remember that the amount of wool that goes from Australia into China, 50% of it is actually consumed in China. So they are the biggest consumer of Australian wool of any country in the world.
That's something to remember. John, appreciate your time on the Country Hour today.
Thank you very much and happy birthday.
Thank you. Well, let's keep going with some reflections now. Amelia and Lara and Christy Reading is a...
You're at Humbert Condo.
Absolutely, and that's the way it should be. Because, Christy, your reflections first up on the Country Hour, because you were involved in the program for quite a long time.
Yeah, for a few years when I first got back from living in London. Mm. So that was quite the contrast to come home. But, look, I was born and raised on a property just south of Tamworth at Gowrie, near Gunaganu Station, and have really fond memories of sitting in the ute next to my granddad on the right, my nan on the left. And having to listen to the markets, not really understanding
having
what all those...
To
well, you know, when you're between two people, you don't really get a chance to move. But, you know, not realising what all those numbers meant all those years ago. And then, you know, coming full circle and being able to report for the Country Hour has been a real highlight of my career. And I've been thinking a bit about the highlights of reporting in that time. And I think for me... the state government buying back the BHP Billiton licences on the Liverpool Plains. That was 2016. Mm. I'd only been back home for a couple of months and that happened, which was massive. You know, you think about the Caruna blockade, you think about the properties that then, you know, went up for sale, but that was a really big time. In 2016, there were a lot of floods around our region at that time as well. I know Tony Windsor mentioned Kevin Moore earlier too. You know, Kevin's just been such a great advocate for agriculture and enthusiastic about what he's done. And look, you know, even down to the colour stories, a little girl from Woolbrook called Alyssa Brown, 4 years old, won her very first dog trial at the age of four with her dog Shazza. I mean, nothing says nothing says Country Hour like that story. So, and I know the girls here have you know, said it previously, but, you know, it's been a real privilege to report on anyone's stories in good and in bad. But I think particularly in agriculture, which can turn, a season can turn, you know, in the blink of an eye, it's a real privilege to tell people's stories, particularly when you're talking to people about, you know, often their financial situations. You know, you're talking to them about their income and their livelihood, and for people to let us into their lives on such a personal level is, you know, should be commended to all of those that give us their time to share their stories. Mm. So, yeah.
I can see that Lara and Amelia are nodding there. Any other reflections we have?
Look, I've been a rural reporter across Queensland and New South Wales.
And that's all right. That's it. We don't hold you against you. That's right.
Gosh.
Exactly.
Christy does every day. I think it's people allowing me in the many emergencies I've covered to walk in their door and share the worst of what they're going through. And then for me to walk away and leave them, but to be able to come back when they're recovering and tell the stories of the good times that come around again.
Mm,
yeah. We're all going to turn into a blubbering mess. We better go to the market, I'd say.
Time to go to the markets. Essential listening. Let's go to Casino Cattle now.
Good afternoon. It was a rare occasion this week where export cattle outnumbered young cattle in a yarding of 1,623 head, which included around 800 cows. There was a fair penning of weaner cattle also. Quality of the young cattle was mixed in a market that saw restocker weaners sell firm to 10 cents cheaper. Restocker weaner steers sold from 420 to 584 cents, with the medium weights averaging 508. Restocker weaner heifers range from 346 to 450 cents, and feeder and backgrounder yearling steers 398 to 510. Yearling heifers sold from 380 to 412 cents. Bullocks and steers met a firm market, topping at 452 cents, and grown heifers up to 420. There were several runs of well-finished heavy cows through the sale, two and three scores sold from 2 to 8 cents dearer, while heavy cows held firm. Two score medium weights sold from 324 to 385 cents, three score medium weight cows averaged 376, and heavy cows sold from 388 to 411 cents. Best of the heavy bulls, 402 cents. Doug Robson at Casino.
Let's go to Carcor Sheep and Lambs.
Numbers are backed by 2,200 for a yearning of 5,000 lambs. Quality remains mixed, with light store lambs well supplied, with limited numbers of good trade and heavy lambs, along with large supplies of Dorpers. Not all the regular buyers are operating. Lightweight new season lambs to process sold dearer, selling from 190 to 230. Trade weight new season lambs 20 to 24 kilos dropped 15 to 20, selling from 234 to 278, averaging 1080 to 1120 cents per kilo carcass weight. Heavyweights over 24 kilos are down 25, $275 to $336. Young lambs to restockers were 10 cheaper, $80 to $225. There was 4,100 mixed quality mutton yarded and prices lifted 5. Merino ewes sold from $70 to $210 and crossbred ewes $70 to $279. Crossbred wethers reached $225 and rams sold to $150. Most sheep sold in the range of $720 to $780 cents per kilo carcass weight. This is Angus Williams for MLA at CTLX.
And let's go to cow, sheep and lambs now as well.
Numbers were back for a yarding of 3,300 lambs. Quality was good with short trade and heavy lambs well supplied, along with light store types suitable for restockers or the regular buyers were operating. Lightweight processing lambs 18 kilos sold from 184 to 204. Trade weights 20 to 24 kilos held firm, selling from 232 to 292, averaging 1100 to 1200 cents per kilo. Heavyweights over 24 kilos were dearer, selling from 292 to 330. Heavy hoggets reached 241. There was 1,000 mixed quality mutton yard and prices were strong. Merino ewes sold from 138 to 185 and crossbred ewes 120 to 308. Most sheep sold in the range of 700 to 760 cents per kilo. This is Angus Williams at Cowra.
Let's go to Yash, sheep and lambs.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers fell to 12,000 and just under 10,000 were new season lambs. The quality was better with not as many dry lambs and a few more heavy trade and heavyweights. There were plenty of stores but fewer restockers. New season light store lambs to 16 kilos were $6 dearer, 148 to 190. Heavyweights were cheaper, selling to 196. Trade new seasons were firm to $2 easier, with trade buyers picking up the drier lambs that restockers were purchasing last week, and they ranged from 212 to 257. Heavyweights were $3 dearer, 250 to 296 to average 1040. Shorn new season trades, 215 to 238, were up $2, and heavyweights reached 270, which remained firm. Mutton numbers lifted to 13,100, prices up to $20 dearer on the heavyweights, with heavy crossbred ewes 236 to 287, merino wethers reached 268, and most have been ranging from 750 to 830. The balance of the lambs and sheep are still to be sold.
Let's go to Mossvale Cattle and David Kent's there. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon, Michael. Numbers, there was a slight decrease in numbers for a total yarding of 2,551, fair to good quality cattle. Young cattle suiting the restockers and feedlot buyers were well supplied, along with a few good runs of well-finished yearlings to suit the processors. There was an increased number of heavy grain cattle and 345 cows. Full field of buyers were operating, selling to a slightly softer market. Yearlings to suit the trade, mostly firm, 452 to 512. Feeder steers ease 5, 410 to 490. Heifers to feed slipped 8, 397 to 452. Young cattle returning the paddock did not reach the highs of last week. The steers selling from 315 to 568. Heifers 300 to 470. Heavy grain steers firm to a few cents easier. 400 to 485. Heifers reached 455 to average 442. 2 and 3 score cows lifted 3, 270 to 398. Prime cows back 4, reaching 422 to average 403. There's still 2 agents to complete their run. This is David Kent at Mossvale for MLA.
Let's go to Singleton Cattle now and Angus Barlow.
Good afternoon. Supply of cows and older cattle increased today, with Singleton agents penning a total of 1,341 head. Light steer calves were considerably cheaper, selling from 358 to 542, with the bottom end dragging back averages. Medium weights faring better to be dearer, as quality was of a higher standard overall, and they sold from 420 to 528. Over 330 kilo steer calves, little change, 460 to 508. Light heifer calves, 8 cents a kilo cheaper, 288 to 410. Medium weight yearling steers to background and feed unchanged, 410 to 466. Over 400 kilos to lot feeders, a similar result, selling from 420 to 470. Big runs of secondary yearling heifers distorted the market, and they made from 210 to 390. B-muscle yearling heifers to the trade made up to 454. Grown steers and bullocks to process, 320 to 446. Two-score cows saw the market fluctuate around quality, and they sold from 192 to 350. Three-score cows dipped 2 cents a kilo, selling from 320 to 408. And heavy four-scores with increased southern processor activity were 6 cents a kilo dearer, selling from 388 to a top of 420 cents a kilo. Angus Barlow for MLA at Singleton.
And that's the market information for today and some reflections. I think we've had a pretty good birthday for the country hour. We've gone through, it hasn't been too self-indulgent. We've gone through some of the issues over the last 80 years.
Well, I haven't seen a bottle of champagne yet.
No.
I brought some wine up from the Hunter. Sorry about that. But we can remedy that later. But I think, yeah, thank you to those who have come out from the public to join us for the country hour today. we, you know, I think the girls have all said it. We're in such a privileged job here, and to the whole team as well.
Yeah, I think we just want to say also thank you to the Tamworth Ag Institute, but a really big thank you to all of our rural reporters in the team. They work hard. They're committed to the country hour and their communities too. And, yeah, they deserve a very, very big round of applause. And I suppose you too, Connor.
No, I'm
fearless leader.
I suppose so. Begrudgingly. Well, maybe we should have a song. Let's happy birthday.
I'm not singing on the radio.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday,
dear country hour.
Happy birthday to you.
Hip, hip,